Iran's Islamist rulers start using their judiciary to impose harsh punishment on anti-government protesters. An Oslo-based rights activist says the United Nations should hold Tehran accountable for violating protesters' rights by launching an investigation.
Close to 40 children have been killed. There are like thousands arrested. We don't know under what conditions they are staying. So it's urgent. So it must happen in the coming days.
Plus, a shooter kills at least 13 people at an Iranian Shiite shrine in Shiraz. We'll get reaction to Iran blaming the attack on Islamic State terrorists. And later in the program, we'll update you on U.S. efforts to free three Iranian Americans whom officials say are being held hostage by Iran. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran's protest movement against Islamic rule is in its seventh week. VOA's Persian service has verified reports of protests in 133 cities and 129 universities. Here is some sound from those student protests. With chants like "Death to the Islamic Republic," the students are demanding regime change. But as VOA Persian news producer Hamideh Aramideh told me in our studio, the Iranian government is fighting back through the courts.
I would like to start with recent development in the trial of seven imprisoned protesters. 22-year-old Mohammad Ghobatlu, who was arrested less than 2 months ago, has been issued the first death sentence. His mother says that he was sentenced to death in only one court session without his own lawyers present or any sufficient evidence against him. His defense lawyer has published a series of tweets related to defects in the case to inform the public. It seems that the government wants to execute this sentence soon. Unfortunately, at least six more imprisoned protesters are waiting for sentencing from the same court. They could all potentially face the death penalty.
What is the reason for the Iranian authorities trying to impose death sentences on protesters?
Because of their fear. They are afraid of the people. They want to make a very tense atmosphere. So people, students, have been at the forefront of the struggle for greater social and political freedoms. They state that they are not afraid and will stand on until the end. So it's very scary for the Iranian government.
What is your impression of these protests so far, you know, after 7 weeks?
Protests and strikes will continue in Iran. There is no doubt about it. Iran's government may control the situation for a while with violence, arrest, executions, and fear tactics. However, the situation in Iran will never return to how it was 7 weeks ago. The population does not simply want reforms. They want regime change. People inside and outside of Iran have expressed their demand for regime change and have asked world governments to cut off their diplomatic and economic relations with the Islamic Republic. Prominent women call for removal of Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. So the Iranian community wants more sanctions on Iran's regime that considers its own people as enemy. Protesters are asking the media of the world to reflect the current events and demands of the Iranian protesters, as well as the actions of the Iranian regime continuously and correctly. They want the media of the world to reflect the wishes of Iranian community in their press. They want information to come from the people themselves, not from individuals and organizations affiliated with the Iranian government abroad. They believe that in order to maintain their territorial integrity and independence, they need international support and the world standing by their side.
Well, Hamideh Aramideh, producer and host with the VOA Persian service, thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much.
Iranian diaspora activists and their allies have been showing their support for the protesters in Iran by staging rallies around the world. Reporter Svetlana Pristinska brings us a sampling of the latest solidarity protests in Europe and here in the U.S.
A human chain across the globe connected thousands of Iranians and supporters of political freedom in Iran with rallies in Oslo, Norway, in Prague, in London's Trafalgar Square, and on the U.S. National Mall in Washington, D.C. In Los Angeles, Iranian-American El Bigi came out to call for freedom, democracy, and justice in Iran.
The world has seen how much the regime in Iran, Islamic Republic, has been butchering their citizens, girls, boys, young, adult. It's unhuman.
Demonstrator Mehian did not want her last name used because she says she is afraid for friends still in Iran. She says many people have lost communication with their families since the protest started and are calling for unobstructed access to the internet.
I live in Iran for 12 years. I'm here today for support the Iranian people because they want freedom and we are fighting for freedom.
In New York City, Helen Kamali helped organize a joint protest alongside Ukrainian Americans.
I think we have a very similar plight right now in the sense that we are individuals from two nations that are currently being oppressed by brutal dictators. And I believe that by joining efforts together, we're able to amplify the voices of individuals in our country and shine a light on the issues that are going on abroad.
Back in Los Angeles, actor and director Bahram Zarakzari says it is duty of all Iranians to protest and fight for freedom in Iran when people there are risking their lives to demonstrate against Tehran's rulers.
We are coming here for the support of my people. The regime attacked the women, attacked the people. I want the people, Persian people, coming here and together and, support Iranian people in my country.
Organizers of the protests are calling on governments around the world to make persona non grata all ambassadors of the Islamic Republic of Iran and their representatives in international organizations. Svetlana Pristinska for VOA News, Los Angeles, California.
UN human rights experts have urged the UN Human Rights Council to hold a special session in response to Iran's crackdown on the protests. They want the council to launch an international investigation to hold Iran accountable for rights violations. Mahmoud Amiri Mogadam is head of Iran Human Rights, a Norway-based NGO. I asked him why he thinks a special UN council session would help.
A special session by itself shows the international community's willingness to do something. So if a session like that is going to happen, it must happen soon. Because, you know, it's very urgent right now. People are being killed every day. According to Iran human rights documents, close to 40 children have been killed. There are like thousands arrested. We don't know under what conditions they are staying. So it's urgent. So it must happen in the coming days.
Can you tell our listeners, what does it mean when you talk about an international investigative mechanism?
Well, it's not only investigative mechanism, but it also meant to hold accountable those who are responsible for the atrocities. So the United Nations doesn't have so many mechanisms to address what is going on the ground in Iran now. And we know that, you know, in the past, normally United Nations come into the picture when it is already very late. So last time it was in Syria, we all remember, you know, before ISIS, when Assad was, with the help of the Revolutionary Guards, Iranian Revolutionary Guards, they were killing civilians. Thousands of civilians were killed, those protesting against Assad. And a few years later, Human Rights Council established an investigative mechanism. It's something like that we are calling for. However, we want it to happen earlier. So what basically it does is It's under UN supervision. It collects documentations for serious human rights violations, and it paves the way for accountability. So basically, if one of Iranian officials who is, according to this mechanism, involved in these atrocities, if he travels outside Iran, a country can actually arrest and based on this investigation and documentation that he has been collected by this mechanism, put him on trial. But you know, we haven't had so many mechanisms of this kind before. So basically what we want is a clear message from the international community that it's not only about condemnations and resolutions and not only symbolic acts, but it is going to have consequences, practical consequences.
Besides potentially arresting an official accused of human rights violations, when that official would go from Iran to somewhere else, is there any other way that an investigative mechanism could produce accountability for, you know, Iranians, especially if they remain inside Iran?
As long as they remain inside Iran and as long as they still are in power, it will, of course, not be possible to hold them accountable, you know, putting them on trial. But you see, if you look at the way Iranian authorities are acting now, you know, they shut down or cut off the internet or put restrictions on it. They deny that they are killing and shooting at the people. They force families to sign fake death certificates because they are actually afraid of the international community to see actually what is happening. So I think an investigative mechanism will at least be a very serious pressure on the authorities. It will increase the cost of the atrocities that they are doing. And also, it sends a very important message to Iranian people, because another reason for cutting off the internet is to tell people that nobody hears you and we can do whatever we want to you. But if United Nations comes with an action, at least the best they can, I think it sends an important message to people in Iran that we hear you and we are willing to defend your rights.
Mahmoud Amiri Mokaddam, Director of Iran Human Rights in Oslo, Norway, thank you for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iranian authorities say they have arrested an accomplice of the assailant who shot and killed 13 worshippers at a Shiite shrine in the city of Shiraz on October 26th. Authorities earlier reported the shooter died from wounds sustained when he was subdued at the Shah Chiragh Mausoleum. Iran blames the attack on the Islamic State group, also known as ISIS. I asked Alex Vatanka, an Iran analyst at the Middle East Institute, why many Iranians are skeptical of Islamic State involvement.
The attack was a bit of a surprise because, you know, ISIS has only really carried out two major attacks in the past in Iran in the year 2017 and 18. So it's been some time since we had seen ISIS operating in Iran. And for them to sort of show up in the middle of nationwide protests was a surprise. And it also raised a lot of questions. And there was a lot of skepticism in certain Iranian diaspora community, but also inside of Iran, on whether this was a false flag operation essentially done by the regime or elements within the regime as a way of deflecting from the protests that are happening, and perhaps even as justifying a harsher crackdown, sort of use the incident as a pretext to say, okay, now gloves are off, we're going to go out there and suppress these protesters much more harshly than we've done because now ISIS is involved. So it just tells you quite a bit about the mood. Anything that the regime says about anything at this moment in time really isn't taken at face value. And that's their problem. Because the regime has made so many false claims in the past, what it has to say about the incident is still being questioned by many circles.
Well, the Iranian officials have been saying since the attack happened that this should be a warning to the people of what can happen if protests continue, if there's ongoing instability. What kind of impact do you think their messaging is going to have?
So you have a nationwide protest that's been going on for months that has not involved people with machine guns shooting at anyone. And then the fact that the regime wants to connect the two raises these suspicions about what motives the at least elements inside the Iranian regime might have had to allow for this attack to happen. So I think ISIS is certainly no friend of the Islamic Republic. And we have a good-sized Sunni minority inside of Iran, a population of around 10 million or more, that you know, have good reasons to be angry with the way the government runs that country and treats particularly minorities like the Sunnis. But we don't really have much of a track record of ISIS being able to recruit among Iran's Sunni minority. And as I said, we've only have had a handful of relatively isolated ISIS attacks inside of Iran. So the timing in the middle of the nationwide protest and the way how the regime very quickly wanted to link that incident to the protest, these are the sort of factors that raise questions, at least, about what really might have been behind this attack on Shah Cheragh in Shiraz, the shrine.
How does this attack that happened compare to how Islamic State terrorists have carried out attacks before? Because some observers have been saying that it doesn't look like a typical kind of Islamic State attack.
Certainly, if you look at the 2017 attack on the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, and the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini, and the attack on the military parade in the city of Ahvaz in 2018, that's exactly what the ISIS gunmen did. They attacked using machine guns, and that was it. There wasn't suicide bombing involved, at least not in the initial stages of the attack. So, you know, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that, you know, obviously space for operation for ISIS is far more limited in a place like Iran than what ISIS is used to in places like Syria, Iraq, or Afghanistan. You know, in the case of Afghanistan, you see suicide attacks targeting mosques, primarily Shia mosques. You haven't seen that in Iran. You've seen individuals with machine guns carrying out attacks, which to me suggests that their ability to operate is that much more limited, because Iran does, after all, have 16 different intelligence agencies. It's a pretty well monitored country, and for ISIS to operate in Iran is a much more challenging task than it is in countries like, certainly in recent past, in places like Iraq and Syria.
Well, Alex Vitanka, director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute, thank you for speaking with us from Washington, D.C. on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
The Biden administration says it remains a priority for the U.S. to secure the release of three Iranian Americans whom it describes as hostages of Iran. 1 month after Iran allowed a fourth elderly Iranian American, Bakir Namazi, to leave the country for medical treatment. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley addressed the issue on October 31st during a webinar for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Imad Shargi, Siamak Namazi, Murad Tabaz, all three deserve to be home. They should never have been imprisoned. It's an outrageous practice that the Iranian government has had, which is to use these dual nationals as pawns. They need to be home, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that day comes as soon as possible.
Jared Genser is a lawyer who worked for the release of Bakir Namazi and now is focused on doing the same for Bakir's son, Siamak, one of three U.S. citizens still jailed in Iran on what the U.S. says are bogus charges. I asked Genser how Bakir Namazi has been doing since departing Iran on October 5th.
Bakir Namazi spent about a week in Abu Dhabi at the Cleveland Clinic. He is making, thankfully, a rapid recovery. He did not require the surgery that Iranian doctors have said he needed. There are other means that can be tried before that to address the blockage to one of the main arteries to his brain. And he's now back in Dubai and resting comfortably at his son's home, Babak Namazi, in Dubai, and making a slow but steady recovery. And, you know, it's been, you know, obviously quite a transition for him after many, many years as a hostage in Iran. To finally see his son, Babak, who we hadn't seen for 6.5 years, as well as his two grandchildren, who we hadn't seen in person either. That's been obviously, you know, incredibly heartwarming and rejuvenating. But obviously, at the same time, he and the rest of the family remain incredibly worried about the situation of his other son, Siamak Namazi, who remains a hostage in Tehran's Evin prison.
Now, Siamak was sent back to Evin prison after a 10-day furlough, his first since he was arrested years ago. What can you tell us about his situation? Because we understand that he was put in solitary confinement after his return to prison.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, Siamak Namazi was only given a 10-day furlough and then returned to Evin prison just before the major fire and an uprising within the prison itself. Thankfully, he is okay, but he remains detained in now the wing of the prison controlled by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC. This is a place where he was in solitary confinement and tortured for 2 intense years before being sent to the general ward of Evin prison. So we remain very, very concerned that he continues to be held there for no reason. He has moved from solitary confinement to a cell with another prisoner, so he's doing a little bit better. He's been able to make a few outgoing phone calls. So we know that he is surviving. But, you know, if the government of Iran is so convinced that he remains in danger inside the prison, then he should, you know, be immediately given another furlough. Ultimately, it's of no value to Iran if Siamak Namazi or the other American hostages were to die in their custody. Then there's no value, obviously, for a negotiation. So we would urge that Siamak be allowed to out on furlough again. And as soon as possible, so he can be safe and secure at his family's apartment in Tehran, while the U.S. government and Iran, through proxies, try to, you know, end up in a final resolution of these hostage cases.
Well, on the topic of U.S.-Iran prisoner negotiations, they have been going on for quite some time through third-party mediators. What can you share with us about the latest situation of such negotiations?
Well, you know, it's been the family position of the Namazis, for whom I serve as pro bono counsel, that the United States needs to do whatever is necessary to bring now Siamak Namazi and the other American hostages home as quickly as possible. You know, all we really know is that there are ongoing discussions underway through third-party intermediaries. We don't have much information about details about how those are going, but they are, you know, ongoing, which is, you know, better than the alternative, because we've had extended periods of time when we have known that for a fact that there have been no negotiations underway. So the fact that they are talking is better than not. Obviously, we don't know where this is going to head, but you know, ultimately, we would call on all sides to come to a final resolution that would bring the American hostages home as quickly as possible.
Do you and the Namazi family have any position on what kinds of concessions the U.S. might have to offer in order to get Siamak and the others out of Iran?
I mean, I think that, you know, the position that Namazis have always taken is that the U.S. needs to do what's necessary to bring the American hostages home. I can say, as a lawyer who's worked in the field of arbitrary detention under international law for many years and have dealt with many American hostage cases in various countries over my career, that, you know, obviously we don't want to do anything to encourage future hostage taking, but that, you know, ending hostage taking as a state practice is a longer term endeavor. But, you know, from the Namazis perspective right now, the focus is on doing what's necessary to bring all of the American hostages home as quickly as possible.
Jared Genser, international human rights lawyer, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of today's program. There's more VOA coverage of Iran 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm Michael Lippin. On behalf of the Flashpoint Iran team, thank you for listening, and we invite you to join us again next week.